extremely good science came out. The pioneering studies of the thermo-optic behavior of solids, their photoelastic properties, magneto-optics, fluorescence, the second order Raman effect for which the department became famous, infrared spectroscopy, and so on. Many may not know that X-ray topography was first discovered in this laboratory and applied to the study of imperfections in diamond. One could go on and on about the work done in this department in that period. In 1948, he was to retire from the Indian Institute of Science. He had hoped to start a small institute for himself with his life savings, where he could retire and enjoy science. But he lost most of his savings in a South Sea bubble-like investment. He was 60 then, and to anyone else it would have been an impossible situation. He was undeterred. He went round the country to collect money. Our greatest men have been beggars, he said, the Buddha, the Shankara, and even Gandhi. He collected about 3 lakhs, but just enough to start the institute, but not to sustain it. He then courageously launched on a new scheme, which was completely new to him. Advised and aided by an old and loyal student, he started a couple of chemical factories. The dividends from these were sufficient to support his institute and to make it independent of government funds. He was made a national professor. Raman was never a member of too many committees, but on his retirement he resigned from every one of them. There is a story, this has to be verified, that a feeler was sent to see whether he would like to be the vice president of India. He is reported to have had a hearty laugh and inquired, "What shall I do with it?" For some time there was no equipment or even electric power in the institute, but he arranged his fantastic minerals and crystal collection and commenced his researches in the color and iridescence of minerals and gems. It was remarkable how much information he could extract by just sending a beam of light into a gem and observing the scattered light. This led him on to his classical papers on the optics of heterogeneous media. He took students, but this time with great discrimination. Once more he established a laboratory, this time the Raman Research Institute, as a great center of research. Outstanding research publications came out of the institute. The generalized theory of interference, the theory of optical activity of crystals, Raman spectroscopy, and a spate of other papers. But perhaps the least understood and the most criticized phase of Raman's life was when he suddenly chose to make himself a recluse. He would no longer accept any support to his institute from government. To ministers who came to give him money, he said, "Why do you want to despoil this only oasis of freedom in this country?" He built high walls around the institute and put up a prominent sign stating that visitors were not welcome. He took no more students. His attitude, particularly towards the government, was one of utmost cynicism. It was during this period that he launched upon his researches on the physiology of vision and on floral colors. He obviously enjoyed this. He was happy, surrounded by his exquisite roses, the jacarandas and the bougainvilleas, the hibiscuses and the morning glories, and he investigated their colors. But those of us who met him knew he was a soul in agony. He was veritably like Shakespeare's Timon of Athens, bitter and cynical. The explanation for all this was not far to seek. To him, scientific activity was a fulfillment of an inner need. His approach to science was one of passion, one of curiosity, one of simplicity, an attempt to understand. To him, science was based on independent thought combined with very hard work. Science was a personal endeavor, an aesthetic pursuit. It was to him a joyous experience. I am now not going to make any value judgment, but I am going to put forward Raman's point of view. The Indian scientific scene presented to him a very different picture. The establishment seemed to believe that scientists cannot be grown in this country, so they sent large numbers of very bright young students abroad for training. He saw the expenditure of large sums of money, and according to him, in completely wrong places, in the belief that science and therefore technology will automatically be created. He saw the replacement of quality by quantity. He saw the choice of research topic, and this hurt him most, dictated only by foreign fashions. But we can imagine how he would have felt, a total negation of all values he had lived by. He must have felt that his example had been totally been in vain. He blamed the establishment for all this. But I think we can forgive him for these feelings. My life, he once cried, literally cried, has been an utter failure. I thought I would try to build true science in this country. Instead, we have a legion who profess science, but who are camp followers of the West. To my mind, the agony of Raman can only be compared to the agony of Gandhi in Noakhali. When he too found all his life's work was not, the apostle of nonviolence seeing his countrymen beating each other to death. It was in this phase that Raman resigned from the Royal Society of London. And here again, the picture is not completely clear. But Raman did come out of this slough of despond, finally. Almost every day he was seen taking around school children and college students around his institute, making them laugh and regaling them with stories and showing them experiments. He began accepting lecture engagements. His charisma was still there and amongst the younger generation. He attracted enormous audiences in the universities, and halls began overflowing again. He made fervent pleas to the government to improve the school and university education and university research. He said, when we want to achieve anything, whether it be in science or anything else, we must first learn to use and to exploit the resources we have in plenty. As a nation, what are the resources we have in plenty? Human beings, of whom at least a third are young. This is our real strength. If they are enthused, and if they are instilled with a spirit of adventure, he said, the sleeping giant must wake up, and we can conquer the world. Raman was, of course, the supreme egotist. But in private conversation, he often showed such an unbelievable scientific humility that one often wondered which was the put-on job. He always told people what he felt, and no wonder they were hurt. He was a man of emotion. He could get violently angry. Some of us still remember how he wept like a child in one of the academy lectures when pictures of children of our land suffering from nutritional ailments were shown. He had an incredible sense of humor, and he could keep us roaring with laughter just describing what could have been a commonplace incident. He was really a very simple man, quite childlike, and sometimes very childish. Once, when Ashutosh Mukherjee pulled him up for buying apparatus without formal sanction, he told him that he should not bother him with such trivial matters like financial sanction. This from an old finance officer. I know when to buy apparatus, but if I do not produce good science, then please pull me up, he said. He was a very naive person. For example, he felt that the only method, might have been foolish, but he felt that the only method of promoting science was by doing science. To him, the professional organizer of science was an anathema. For them, he said, the so-called organization of science was more important than science itself or its values. Science is generated by the mind of man and not by research proposals or annual reports. If scientific judgment is to be developed in a country, it needs an academy with unfettered, courageous scientists, not bureaucratic ones subservient to government. Statements that may be acceptable to the young, but not to the establishment. To him, the simplest observations that he could make by just looking around him were worthy of the deepest scientific investigation. He demonstrated over decades that a deeper understanding of these everyday phenomena paved the way to the discovery of fundamental laws. He once humorously remarked of Gandhi, "There is a man who is excited about problems in his immediate surroundings." He was really a classical physicist who had discovered a most important quantum phenomenon. He relied greatly on intuition. In fact, Max Born once said, "Raman's quick mind leaps over mathematics." Anyone who met him could not but be struck by the zest for life and for living. It is probably of this that Born refers to in his letter to Lord Rutherford, later written in the late half of the 30s. "There is no Indian physicist of the rank of Raman. No man can compare with him in regard to vigor or intensity. This European intensity which Raman exhibited to a marked degree would make any average Indian scientist suspicious of him." His exuberance was infectious. Chatting with him for some time was like taking a tonic. To many of us who knew him well, what struck us most was his intense love and preoccupation with nature. The colors of birds, the sheen of the beetles, the blue of the sky, the variegated colors of the sea, the spectacular hues of the coronas and glories that surrounded the sun and the moon, the extraordinary beauty of minerals, crystals, and gems not only thrilled him, but formed the subject matter of his scientific studies. I remember once, a few months before he died, while walking with him one evening amongst the eucalyptus groves that he loved, he stopped me in his characteristic manner, and pointing towards the sky, he said, "Have you seen anything so beautiful?" Above, one saw little wisps of multicolored clouds passing close to the moon, which gleamed over the shimmering leaves of the trees, trees which appeared like nature's own cathedral. "This is happiness," he said, "that we should be alive, that we should be endowed by nature the faculty to perceive this fleeting beauty, vision of beauty. This is happiness indeed." Thank you.
Lady Raman and friends, about a year and a half ago, I made a brief visit to a small town situated on the outskirts of the Black Forest in West Germany. The town is called Freiburg, and as many of you know, it has an ancient and renowned university. Freiburg does not have an airport, so I reached there by train, and I was met by a friend, and as we were proceeding towards the hotel, I saw all along the roads and at every traffic intersection all over the city conspicuous bold orange-yellow signs marked Raman, Raman, all over the place. The reason was that in Freiburg at that time was being held the 5th International Conference on Raman Spectroscopy. About 300 scientists from all over the world were assembled. The object of my visit was to extend, on behalf of the various academies of science in this country, an invitation to hold the next conference in Bangalore to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the Raman effect. And after a week's deliberations, the invitation was accepted. And accordingly, in September of this year, the 6th conference will be held in Bangalore. The government of India has given the clearance, and various international organizations have sponsored the conference. And also to preserve the sort of international character of the commemoration, in the sense that it is not just India which is celebrating the 50th anniversary, but the world community of scientists, an international organizing committee has been formed. of which the chairman is Professor James Durig of the United States. Professor Durig issued the first circular announcing the conference some few months ago, and the second circular has also just come out. And I'll just show you the circular. It has a profile of Professor Raman there, and it reads the 6th International Conference on Raman Spectroscopy to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the discovery by C.V. Raman of the effect which bears his name. And after this week, I was proceeding back to the railway station and had a last look at those conspicuous, you know, flashy signs all over the city marked Raman, Raman. And I reflected that here was a man who had not wielded great power in the sense that he had not been the president of a country or the prime minister, whom the city of Freiburg was honoring in order to improve trade relations between India and West Germany or to win one more vote at the United Nations. He was an ordinary man in that sense, born and brought up in South India like many of us here, not at all of wealthy parents, whose formal education ended when he was about 17 and a half or 18 years old, who never had had any higher training, higher research training, as appears to be the prerequisite these days, higher research training abroad, whose higher physics was entirely self-taught. Although it is said that he has told some friends that he regarded Rayleigh and Helmholtz as his mentors. But if Rayleigh and Helmholtz were his teachers, as was the case with Ekalavya in the Mahabharata, he never met them personally. They were teachers by proxy. And yet, by sheer courage and determination, turned out to be one of the outstanding physicists of the 20th century and started a school of research in India, probably the first ever since the times of Nalanda and Takshashila. And that too at a time when there was no organized support of science in the country, no Department of Science and Technology or CSIR or University Grants Commission or anything of that sort. And as I was boarding that train, I asked myself the question, how is it that from such ordinary beginnings he was able to achieve so much? And what was his motivation? I doubt if anyone can even attempt to answer this question. We know little about the workings of the mind of a genius. But what we can do is to get glimpses of the man and his work. And that is what we propose to do today. And as Professor Kuchela explained just now, it being the in this very hall 50 years ago, on this day, 16th of March, that he made the first scientific account, gave the first scientific account of the discovery, the crystallized version of a hunch, a germ of an idea that had taken root nearly 8 years previously. And like all those of you who might have seen this original paper, like all great ideas or most great ideas, easy to read and with profound insight into the future possibilities of this phenomenon now called the Raman effect. So what we propose to do is to have, as I said, accounts of his career from starting first with Calcutta. And we have 5 speakers. I'm proud to introduce them, and I'm also honored that they have taken this trouble to come all the way on this historic occasion. The first speaker is Dr. L.A. Ramdas, Emeritus Scientist of the National Physical Laboratory in New Delhi. Those of you who might have read the Nobel lecture will recall that Dr. L.A. Ramdas's name figures in connection with the pioneering studies on the surface scattering from liquids and so on and so forth. And also, it turns out that he was the first person to introduce the nomenclature, the Raman effect. He will talk about the what I regard as the heroic days of Calcutta, the most creative period of Professor Raman's life. I should add here that Dr. Ramdas has gone to a great deal of effort to come just for one day for this very special meeting, and we're grateful to you, sir. The second speaker will be Dr. Raghavendra Rao, who was a student, MA, MSc student in Calcutta University, and therefore had contacts with Professor Raman during the last year or two of his stay in Calcutta, and subsequently became a student at the Indian Institute of Science for the first 3 or 4 years. The papers by Raman and Rao are oft quoted. If you look up any, say, book like Frenkel's Kinetic Theory of Liquids, you will find the papers of Raman and Rao. The first studies on the Brillouin scattering by liquids, which demonstrated the increase in the hypersonic velocity with increase of frequency, and thus showed that liquids have a dynamic shear modulus at these very high frequencies. Dr. Raghavendra Rao will cover, as I said, the last year or two at the at Calcutta and the first years at the Indian Institute of Science. The third speaker is Dr. Nedungadi, who will cover the next several years, probably up to the year 1942. Dr. Nedungadi worked on the Raman, amongst other things, Raman effect in crystals, and one paper will always be remembered, Raman and Nedungadi in Nature. This was the first experimental observation and a clear recognition of the so-called soft mode and its relation to phase transformation in solid. This concept was rediscovered 20 years later by Cochrane in Cambridge and Anderson in the USSR. And as we all know, it has a profound significance in relation to phase transition theory today. And I wrote to Bill Cochrane and asked him, what about this paper by Raman and Nedungadi? And he said by the time he had received the letter, he had just summarized the history of the soft mode, and he said indeed this was something which they had recognized 20 years ago. Dr. Nedungadi will cover the period from his impressions from 1937 to about 42 or 43. The next speaker is Dr. Ramsation. And I believe it will be quite superfluous on my part to introduce him to a Bangalore audience. A former student of Professor Raman and a close friend and confidant throughout Professor Raman's life, Dr. Ramasation will cover the period 43 after 1943. The final phase by Professor A.K. Ramdas, the Raman Research Institute period. Professor Ramdas, A.K. Ramdas, is the professor of physics at Purdue University in the United States. It so happens he is in India at this time. Now, Dr. Ramdas has, in the last decade or so, been doing some outstanding quantitative studies on Raman infrared and Brillouin spectroscopy of crystals, and I unhesitatingly say that his group will stand in the first 3 or 4 of the most outstanding groups in the special field of spectroscopy. And Dr. Ramdas will cover the last, maybe, you know, after he moved to the Raman Research Institute, probably from the year 1950 onwards. So I have great pleasure in welcoming these distinguished speakers, and I request Dr. Ramdas, L.A. Ramdas, to give us his talk.
I must thank the Indian Physics Association for being so good enough to invite me to speak a few words at this historic occasion. On March 3rd, I happened to give the Raman Memorial Lecture at the Indian Institute of Science, and I spoke about Professor Raman. I'm told nothing is more wearisome than a twice-told tale, so Shakespeare says. And so I shall slightly deviate from what Professor Chandrasekhar said. I shall talk about some of the documents that I have been able to trace in relation to Professor Raman. So I will not talk about 1943, if it's all right, 1943 to 48, but some of the rather interesting documents that I have been able to trace. About Professor Raman, it must be known to some of the older students. I remember once when he was just establishing the Raman Research Institute about 25 years ago, he suddenly said, "Would you like to see one of the most precious letters that I have with me?" Of course, I said yes, and I thought he was going to show me the letter that he received from Stockholm announcing the Nobel Prize. So we went up, and from his baggy trousers, he took out the key and opened the almirah, and there came three old, faded letters. May I have the first slide, please? This was a certificate given by one of his teachers at the Presidency College. This is written by Professor Wilson, Professor of Physics, Presidency College. Time does not allow you to read the entire thing, but it says, "C. Venkatraman has been one of the best students I've had to deal with during a period of over 30 years. In fact, Professor Raman greatly cherished these professors, because a few weeks after he joined, he was only 13 and a half when he joined Presidency College, there was a discussion, and the professors of physics said, "You need not attend our classes. You can spend it more profitably in the laboratory and the library." And Professor Raman was terribly grateful because of this, and he did use it very profitably, because he produced three very distinguished papers during that period when he was between the ages of 16 and 18. Then I was able to trace another letter. Could I have the next slide? It's a faded letter, and you notice on top, on the right side, Terling Place, Witham, Essex. It's typically British. On the left side, you see Hatfield, Feverel, 2.5 miles, and Witham, 3.5 miles. It's a typical British place, and the date is 15th of July, 1906. And the writer is very concerned. You know, it's very faded, it's very difficult to read. We had to do a lot of contrast work to get this in. The writer is concerned that he has not replied to Raman's letter dated the 10th of May. The writer says, "I put it aside for further consideration. Unfortunately, I overlooked it." Two pages more of this scrawly, fading handwriting, where the writer agrees generally with the scientific explanation given by Raman and encourages him to carry on with the scientific work that he's doing. And finally he ends, next slide please, he ends with renewed apologies, Raleigh R. This letter has been written by Lord Raleigh, the great pillar of British science in those days, the president of the Royal Society. Young Raman at 17 and a half has written to Raleigh, and Raleigh has written back. As Professor Chandrasekhar mentioned, if we have to look for mentors, Raleigh was definitely one of the teachers of Professor Raman. But Professor Raman did possess the two volumes of sound, theory of sound, that Raleigh had written. It is not clear whether the collected works of Raleigh were available in the Presidency College or the University of Madras. But in a sense, it was the Ekalaiva story. But when Raman found that Raleigh was wrong about this blue of the sea, he had no compunction. That's the way of science. He had to destroy the previous idea of Raleigh and prove that it was the molecular scattering that was the cause of the blue of the sky, a sea. And then we know the story, which Professor Ramdas told us, that he passed the finance department examination, and then he discovered the Indian Association for the Cultivation of Science, and then he did this outstanding research in the field of sound. Next slide, please.
This is one of the bulletins. This is the first page of the bulletin. Although it's 1918, the work was done between 1914 and 1916. It deals with the mechanical theory of vibration of bowed strings and of musical instruments of the violin family. It's a thesis almost. It's about 160 pages long, and I'm sure it was published within a week of his writing such a report. But on one of these documents, I found a very interesting inscription. Next slide, please. It is written, private copy, C.V. Raman. And then the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin writes, in memory of my visit to the institute, to an authority on sound from an ignorant violinist. We know that the great Sir Ashutosh Mukherjee offered the Pallith chair to Professor Raman, and Ashutosh writes to the member finance of the Viceroy's Council to know about Raman. Next slide, please. Writes the finance member of the Viceroy's Council that somewhere there, this is just a document, he's most useful in the finance department, being in fact one of our best men, and he's very reluctant to relieve Raman of the finance department duties. But Raman, as it was mentioned, has made up his mind, but there is a problem. The Pallith professorship, one of their conditions, I mentioned this before, was that the person who takes up the Pallith professorship must have been trained abroad. And Professor Raman tells Ashutosh Mukherjee, by God, I am not going abroad to get trained. In fact, the other person who occupied the chemistry chair was Acharya P.C. Rai. And I did not know till recently that Acharya P.C. Rai got his doctorate in Scotland. And so, within quotation, his training was no problem. Then we see a second letter, because Raman has obviously asked for a written guarantee that he will not be sent abroad. And the honorary vice chancellor and the syndicate agree to the condition on which you are prepared to accept the appointment. Then it says that during your incumbency, you will not be required to leave India and proceed to any foreign country. I think I wanted to show this letter and mention this to you. That is, there was a man who felt that he should remain in India. And it was in 1921, Sir Ashutosh had a great deal of difficulty in persuading him to go to England. And thank God he did, because it was then that he saw the blue of the Mediterranean. But I am sure he would have seen something else and got the Nobel Prize if he had not seen the blue of the Mediterranean. But then we know the story. Dr. Ramdas told us of this exciting story. Then the first announcement of the Raman effect, 28th, the observation was made. And on 29, next slide, please. This is the newspaper account of the Raman effect discovery. New theory of radiation, Professor Raman's discovery. The date is February 29th. I do not want to go into this. When he saw it through the direct vision spectroscope, he thought it was an optical analog of the quantum effect, of the Compton effect. And then it states, the astonishing thing is that the altered color is quite independent of the nature of the substance. That's what he saw, because he was using organic liquids. And he thought it was identical. All liquids show the same thing, just exactly as Compton effect did show the same frequency change. But then he has canceled it. This must have happened, because in 3 days they found that this is not correct, because on the 16th, the lecture that he gave here, he definitely knows what the Raman effect is. So he has canceled quite, it is his handwriting, and has written approximately. Then he remembers later that this is a very precious document, so he cancels both, and that is the manner in which Professor Raman normally operates. The last sentence there, it's written here, he will deliver a lecture demonstrating, this is on the 29th of February 1928, it was a leap year, just to remind you, he will deliver a lecture demonstrating these phenomena first at Bangalore on the 16th of March. The 50th anniversary we are celebrating, it has been announced there. There must have been a request, because he was coming for the council meeting of the Indian Institute of Science. Then I found another letter, next slide please, which is the letter written from the South, in the now defunct South Indian Association, written by the secretary, Mr. Srinivasaya. We all knew him when I was a student at the Indian Institute of Science. Professor Srinivasaya is known to all of us. And he writes, thanking Professor Raman for accepting to give the inaugural address. And then the next slide, please. There is this announcement saying that at 6:15 p.m., it's exactly that time almost now, inaugural address by Professor C.V. Raman, FRS, subject, a new radiation. I thought these documents are of some interest. And then, as Dr. Ramdas said, he went back and wrote this almost immediately. Next slide, please. This is the paper that was written and was published on the 31st of March, 1928. It is indeed very exciting that Raman saw the blue, the blue of the seas, and he wanted to understand the beauty of the seas, and the Raman effect was discovered. The beauty in nature was always something that attracted him. And I would like to mention that I once heard a talk, which was later a radio talk, of three books that really influenced him. The first was Euclid, Elements of Euclid. Here he says it is the sheer beauty of logic that hit him. The sheer poetry of logic is what really excited him. Then the next book that influenced him was Helmholtz, the great Helmholtz's book, Sensations of Tone. If I were asked, more than Raleigh, it was Helmholtz who was really the teacher of Raman, because what could be more beautiful than music? And the beauty of the scientific analysis of natural beauty was what excited Raman when he read Helmholtz, and that has been the theme of his life. And the last book that he says that influenced him was Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia, the great book about the life of the Buddha. What could be more beautiful than the human spirit triumphing over everything? Thank you.